Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to serve in behalf of the Department of Home Economics as the master of ceremonies for this final session of the Symposium on the Status of Women. I do this in behalf of the head of the department, Dr. Janice Smith, and the program chairman for this particular event, Dr. Trebilcott. As I want to speak and say on their behalf, to extend a welcome to each of you to join in this particular program. I may also take the liberty to extend a welcome on behalf of the College of Agriculture, of which the Department of Home Economics is a part. We're proud to have a symposium of this caliber and on this particular subject as a part of the centennial events of this year for the University of Illinois. This program is a part of the series of lectures known as the Isabel Bevere Lecture Series that's been devoted this year to a centennial symposium. My function tonight will be very brief. I have the pleasure to present the Chancellor of the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, Dr. Jack Peldison. I want to say just a few words about the Chancellor before I present him to you. He was educated in Missouri and at Princeton University. I believe his work at the PhD level was in the area of political science. At least this is the area in which he did his teaching in subsequent years at Smith College and at the University of Illinois beginning in 1951. He served at this university in the Department of Political Science and rose to the rank of professor to the position of dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences and that position he held until 1964. At that time, he left the University of Illinois to go to the new Irvine campus of the University of California to serve as Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. He stayed in that position until just a few months ago, when we were fortunate enough to bring him back to the University of Illinois to accept the then new post as Chancellor of the Urbana-Champaign campus of this university. I needn't tell you that Chancellor Peldison has had many obligations in connection with assuming this new post. I think he's speaking to some group or meeting with some group not only once a day, but several times a day, and we feel fortunate indeed to have him with us this evening to participate in this program. It takes a pleasure now to present Chancellor Peldison.
Thank you, Dean Bentley. During this centennial year, the University of Illinois has been favored by many exciting events on the campus. And this symposium is yet another one of these enriching experiences. I looked at the title of the symposium, and I noticed it's called University in Motion, the Status of Women. It reminds me what we all know, that to put anything in motion, including a university, we need a woman to do it. And I can't argue with this either here or at home. In any case, I want to congratulate the Home Economics Department for bringing this important topic to focus and for arranging this program in which I am honored to participate. My role tonight is to introduce our guest speaker, and I am pleased and honored to do so. Dr. Paul A. Miller was named by the President as Assistant Secretary for Education in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare on July 5, 1966. In this capacity, he serves as chairman of the Federal Interagency Committee on Education. Previous to his present appointment, Dr. Miller was named president of West Virginia University in 1961. He holds a bachelor's degree from West Virginia University, and after service in the Army Air Corps during the Second World War, he continued his studies at Michigan State University. His special field is in sociology and anthropology, and he is a distinguished scholar in those areas. After joining the faculty at Michigan State He worked his way up to the ranks, as we euphemistically describe the normal academic experience. His teaching experience was followed by service as director of the Cooperative Extension Service and vice president for off-campus education. And in 1962, he was served in the capacity of provost. So we see he has had experience as a government administrator, as a teacher, as a scholar, and as an administrator. His experience also includes service with the Columbian Commission on Higher Education, the Center for the Study of Liberal Education for Adults, and International Voluntary Services. Quite recently, he has been a fellow member with our own Dr. Janice Smith on the National Advisory Commission on Food and Fiber. It's a great deal of pleasure for me to introduce to you our guest, the Honorable Paul A. Miller, who will speak on the topic, Women and the Years Ahead.
Mr. Chancellor and ladies and gentlemen of the audience, you forgot a couple of things. I'm also a husband and a father. Relevant comments for tonight's task. Since this year and a half at a new assignment at a new kind of swimming pool, I've been, Mr. Chancellor, Mr. Dean, interested in the styles of introduction. Sometime I've often said to myself, I'm going, and I'm sure you're sympathetic with this view, sometime in retirement, if that ever comes, I'm going to write a little monograph from a sociological point of view about what chancellors and presidents and deans of universities have to do to come out on nights like this to greet on the one hand and to introduce people on the other. There are always a complex set of motives for doing it. No one has really exposed these motives as yet. And one of the chapters in the book will have to do with the styles which presidents and chancellors take in introducing people. That was nicely done. It was very generous. And I appreciate it because, as a government official, I find in the last year and a half, it isn't always done with such nice style and, and a touch of ceremony. And I wasn't really prepared for that. I, like so many people here, had in a way been born and reared and brought up on an academic campus. And one grows accustomed, especially as he becomes a chancellor, as a president, he grows accustomed, a little fatuous about it indeed. And it's rather gratifying to have the touch of a ceremony and nice words and at least devoted to the office, if not to the person. And I'd grown accustomed to this. And so when I went in on this job the middle of August a year ago, I made up my mind that I was not going to give any speeches for a while, that I was going to at least spend 6 weeks or so trying to learn the ropes of the new job, and that I just would stay out of the speech-making business. And an experience happened to me that's very unique, because the time came that I had to go in and get out on the hustings. And I went to Minneapolis, and I was to speak at a banquet. And as I flew out to Minneapolis, I sort of thought about this, and how would the meeting go, and how would I feel? Because sociologists are interested in such things as self-expectations, the expectations of significant others, and all of that, you know. And well, I got out there, and I had a host, and he was the chairman of the banquet, and they had a cocktail party, which really turned into two, and there were about 700 people at the banquet. The chairman grew increasingly bilious as he tried to get the people out of the cocktail party into the banquet hall, and I was in tow all the while. Well, we finally got to the banquet table about an hour and a half late. I sat beside him. He didn't speak to me throughout the whole meal. I grew increasingly bilious, too. I came to the conclusion that the whole thing should never have happened, and he had already come to that conclusion. Well, they had to honor some people, as always happened at those banquets. And so about 10:30, it was time for the speech. And the chairman got up, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And he looked out on the audience and he said, well, it's time for the speech. And we have Mr. Miller here from Washington. And he gave it a kind of a sinful ring. And I started to grow very cold. There was the lack of the touch of ceremony, the nicety of the academic routine. And I was halfway prepared for it, but I wasn't prepared for what came next. And he said he'd like to speak to us tonight, and that always does something to a speaker. My heart started to descend to the basement, and then something happened to him. He braced his shoulders, planted his feet, and he looked out with a sort of grim look upon his face, pointed his finger out, and he said, I don't want to see a single human being leave this room before or during or after Mr. Miller's speech. And he said, the reason I'm telling you this, there's going to be some excellent live entertainment when he finishes. True story. And so I'm still not altogether prepared, coming onto an academic campus, not for the moment a part of one, and for what will happen. Well, the topic assigned me for the evening session is an impossible one. It would be impossible for anyone, especially for any male, and especially for me. I'm delighted that the wiser heads of the two lovely women on this symposium have been brought to bear upon it. Because when it's all said and done, that will become the saving grace. Indeed, the task calls more for wisdom than for either knowledge or observation. As I sat at my typewriter and tried to prepare these remarks, I agreed with James Steffens, who said in his The Crock of Gold, women are wiser than men because they know less and understand more. Two or three nights ago, when I took my remarks home to do some editing, they'd been typed at the office, and I want to say to you, and I hope you'll forgive me for what will come next, because I've disciplined myself over the years for certain values that I have to really never make a personal mention of one's institution, one's family. Sometimes I'm annoyed with too much anecdotal analyses. And so I just don't do it. But because I'm here talking on a symposium devoted to the status of women, I must somehow reveal the situation that I'm in. Because my wife is a professional person with more than a casual interest in the continuing education of women. And so I with some foreboding, two or three nights ago, threw down these remarks and said, would you look them over? Give me some reactions. I still have time to take things out and put things in. Don't be too rough on me. And so when I got to this, she got just as far as I have been able to get in these remarks about that it was a sort of an impossible assignment. She said, Paul, this is a little trite, and it isn't true anyway. I know you're not very well read in this subject, but after all, you are a father, you are a husband, you do live in the midst of a family, you do have a professional wife, who works sometimes as long hours as you do. And she said, I really think if for no other reason you can speak from that vantage point and you don't have to start out in such an apologetic fashion. And then I leaned back as we sat, and this is the truth, and I told her, well, I said, you know, the trouble with all of this, and I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the University of Illinois. When I get there, there are going to be a couple of hundred people in the audience. And almost all of the 200 people are going to be women. There's going to be 15 or 20 men there. Three or four of those men are going to come because they're sort of curious of what a male is going to do in the midst of a symposium like this. Three or four others are going to come who are going to be old academic buddies, and they'll be interested in seeing how Miller is holding up. And there'll be four or five other men around who are there because it's their duty to be there. And to welcome people who bear such titles as assistant secretaries for education. And I said, the tragedy of it is, and in a way I'm being serious now, as I told her, the tragedy of all of this is that The message that I think that I should give, I shouldn't even write down, and my message should be given to men and not to women. And that's one of the most important points I'm going to make tonight. Because one of the problems of the endless entourage of symposia on the continuing education of women, that only women listen to them, and not enough men. And as we sat there and chat, I said, if I had the courage when I went out there, I would tell them about you. And I would tell them that there is that one husband can say, at least, that he has a professional working wife who sometimes puts in 12 to 14 hours a day, that is a family of three children. I said, if I had courage, I would tell them this. That it's a family which has no cook, drives its own automobiles, worries about its own mortgages, and has a cleaning lady one day a week. And I said, if I were to get just a little bit self-serving, I would tell them that the children seem to be almost impossibly healthy and normal. And that I would also, I said, if I really had a deep felt move to courage, I would tell the ladies, and it should be men, something about the fact that so much of family love, as it has become in American society, is often a kind of institutionalized affection, sympathy, appreciation for the burdens of one wife. I said what I would tell them, that there's another kind of love too, that's rooted in admiration, admiration of vitality, admiration of thrust, of change, of a wife who could teach her husband because she goes out to slay her own dragons. But I said, I won't have courage enough to say that. I might to men, I told her, because most of the men in the audience, if it were the other way around, wouldn't believe it, but they would forgive me for saying it. I said, some of the women won't believe it, most of them will, but those who don't will never forgive me. I said, that's why I'm so uncertain as I start these remarks. As we sat and chatted, I told her, I think for the first time, because it came to me many years ago when I was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I was at a meeting, and someone pointed out a very nice lady of about 70 years of age, and they said, you know, she serves on a United Nations mission, is just back from India and Pakistan, but to this particular meeting this morning in the midst of the winter, she walked 4 miles to meet a Share the Ride automobile at a crossroads in order that she could come to this particular meeting. I, an official of a university at that moment, wanted to meet this lady, and I went up to and talked with her. She was a little Finnish lady that you find in the Upper Peninsula, just back from Pakistan, a learned woman in some of the international aspects of Asia. She was a Finn. And I talked with her and somehow coaxed out of her something of her life. She was a woman who had had 11 children, and she had most of the children, and she couldn't speak English. Her elders did not want her, as the Finnish were very slow to assimilate with American culture, and they didn't want her to do it. And she said, one day I went to a club meeting, not because I really wanted to, only bearing the sympathy of my husband, not the extended family, but I went simply because I had to get away from those 11 children. I thought it was a rather good reason, as I've thought about it since. And she says, I went over there and fellowship was extended to me. And then she said these words. Something started from that point, and I'll skip over it now to make her story short. She said, I spent 20 years before the mirror practicing the English language. And she spoke with a beautiful, faint Finnish touch, but an elegant use and expression of the language, and started out not with it as her native language. But I said, I don't see how you went through on all of this if this extended Finnish system didn't want you to do it. She said, one person helped me do it. And I said, who was that? My husband. Because he told me, I'm a farmer, he said. My occupation ties me down. Go out into the world, find out what this country is like, and bring it back so our children and I myself can somehow learn and enjoy it. My wife and I sat and I chatted, and I told her it was the first time I was able to remember in her presence that old anecdote. And so I'm saying to you that, in a way, my remarks to follow, and I hope in the future that we can have men come to these symposia, because all the ones I've been to are just like this. 200 people, 10 men, half of them there somewhat begrudgingly. Well, so she thought that was a rather complex way to start, and it sort of demonstrated to me, as I sort of put my speech back in my valise and took it away from her, that I have been discovering that as I begin each day with not only the advice of one woman, but also the advice of some 180,000 others she is associated with, that I'm not at all sure that my insight about the phenomenon of woman becomes any more certain. In addition, and I have a kind of self-conception, though you never can be sure about self-conceptions, that I'm a rather normal male, and I have to say to you that it is everlasting more easy and more interesting to think of women in the present than to think of them in the future. And so as I sat and stared at the typewriter and worried about this task, some quite unrelated swirls of interest, partly historical and partly emotional, came to mind. First among them is the seeming paradox of the American woman. Among the conclusions rendered by worldwide communication is that the American woman has come to be admired and emulated by everyone, even by those who have never met her, in far-off primitive countries, in the peasant's village, even in harems. Entire industries have sprung up to satisfy her every whim. She is the best fed, best clothed, best housed, best educated woman in all the world. She is also the most nervous one. And she mothers a family not given altogether to serenity. But my thoughts didn't remain very long on this seeming paradox, and they somehow tended to wander off to the background of the sinewy strength of the American woman. And I've had an interest in this over recent years. Her most ancient forebears were the custodians of the Christian ethic. One recalls the almost pure mysticism of Saint Teresa, and as well the fierce military patriotism of Saint Joan of Arc. The 7th century abbess of Whitley, Saint Hilda, in befriending Cadmian, launched the early traditions of English poetry. Who would not be moved by Saint Elizabeth of Hungary, who in 1225, throughout a period of famine, fed 900 people daily with her own hands? Or Mother Cabrini, who traveled the length and breadth of the Western Hemisphere and left a chain of schools and hospitals in her wake? Or closer home, we remember the pioneer women of America who established a still prevalent capacity of looking ahead. Somehow she learned to toughen her husband's spirit to keep up the fight in the new land, while encouraging her children to split logs, walk long miles to school, practice penmanship with frostbitten fingers, or sell newspapers in the dawn's early light, and with it all, to read the Bible to the whole brood every night. Such rhetoric helps one to come up with the remarkable staying power of the American woman, and this is one of the guidelines out of the past that I somehow am dredging up. A staying power which has, I think, a particular reference to the poignant dignity of endurance and of enduring the never-ending flow of women's work. In James Agee's classic book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the passage that has remained with me the longest refers, and it's had an effect upon me from those early days when I read it. That passage that remains with me refers to Annie Mae, the young mother of a southern sharecropper family. Let me quote from that chapter about Annie Mae at one point. I can do this without reading it because it's been ingrained in my memory. But it goes like this. Annie Mae watches up at the ceiling, and she is as sick with sleep as if she had lain the entire night beneath a just supportable weight. She has not lacked in utter tiredness. Like a load in her whole body a day since she was a young girl, nor will she ever lack it again. But when the ceiling has become visible, there is no longer any help for it, and she wrenches herself up and wriggles a dress on over her head and shuffles barefooted across the porch to the basin and ladles out two dippers of water from the bucket and cups it in her hand and drenches her face in it with a shuddering shock that straightens her and dries on the split flour sack that hangs from a nail and is capable of going to work again. And who among us has not suffered a bit to think of the women of our contemporary inner cities? Who often without benefit of father and husband and with uncertain income manage to somehow limp along to serve their children. But your centennial symposium aims to do more than capture the poignancy of women. But perhaps there is some mysterious connection between this poignancy and a conference such as this one, as well as all those others which have emphasized the topic. For there lurks an anguish, an uncertainty, some lack of identity, or some aberration of achievement in the nature of family and community. I suggest that among the reasons three have occasioned one assembly after another on the role of women in modern society. The first reason is that we are less than pleased with the character of family life. The second reason is that the relationships of women to the world of work, expanding as they are, require continuous appraisal. And the third, since a new era of human development is rising to the service of American life, new questions and new promises come up about the meaning of woman to the contemporary crisis of social relations. In this country and every country of the world, I submit we are in one of the most deep-felt crises of social relations in the history of the world. I turn now to the first of these themes or reasons. The features of urban industrial life, especially in terms of the swiftness by which they have emerged, puzzle us about how best to live amid the separation of job from family and community life. In not more than a single generation, what one does in his occupation, in his family and community, have become functions that refuse to fit together very well for men and women alike. I shall never forget the lady outside Flint, Michigan, when I was interviewing on a sociological study, and she said to me, and I shall never forget it, as she spoke of her husband working in Flint. They're living in a suburb some 30 miles away. And she said these words to me, and they almost went exactly like this. She said, "My husband's heart and his treasure are 30 miles apart." And then she said, "And I have become a waiting room attendant," referring to taking him to the crossroads to share the ride or to the railroad station, wherever it was, and how he was split in his life with reference to his job, with reference to what he wanted to do with his family, and how to fit them together. Well, we can't go back, but all of us have become jugglers of these specialized parts we play, and we ourselves are juggled about in the process. The great stress on occupation has elevated its status and in turn narrowed what is meant by success. In the bargain, Family and community tasks have been commonly thrown back upon themselves for invention. It is fair to say that as women have been partially freed of the burdens of domesticity, something close to anxiety has been left behind. And in a quite remarkable fashion, modern society has shown little interest and new institutional support to make this transition natural and painless. Yet, through hook or crook, we've crowded somewhere into this transition. And we need desperately to devise more quickly the many institutional forms and arrangements which are possible and necessary to reduce further the burdens of domestic life. Here and there, people talk of changes in the tax laws which would allot deductions for newly devised housekeeping and child-rearing services that are purchased. In the recent period, new plans take on added reality for daycare centers with increased public and private support. And I want to add an aside here. As a social scientist, one of the interesting things that, to me, as I've thought about it over the years, how truly naive we are in American society about the nature of love. Because we operate blissfully throughout a society that love is the one capacity that needs not to be recreated and renewed. And that only a family love can really be relevant to the upbringing of children. Though some would question that as assumption, I want to go on the record for feeling that is the best kind of love if it is at its best. But it isn't always at its best. And it isn't at its best because that love is not recreated, I'm saying, and renewed. And the result of this, and society has demonstrated little interest in it, that the result of this is that there are countless families that have institutionalized an existence, rationalized a happiness, which stays in being only because the trouble of undoing it is greater than the courage for it. Although these services are getting off the ground, and still others in the general educational matter, as one of our speakers pointed out this afternoon, it is true that programs for the continuing education of women are expanding in colleges and universities. Much beyond the discussion stage is the question of how our educational institutions may offer lifetime services for a mobile society and gear them imaginatively to the needs of women, how to offer educational guidance, how to take care of records, how to keep track of advanced and refresher courses, and how one may take them and make them count wherever they may live. Perhaps the widespread and recent recognition of the urban crisis was required to remind us that family life, schooling, and community services are properly a continuous and totally interdependent web. Yet we remain ill-developed in building ties between them. And perhaps my most important point, and women have borne most of the burden for the discontinuity. And the result has been less than happy for them. The American woman has not been able because she has not been helped to do so by the general societal structure. In reconciling the various revolutions which have come her way, she has weathered and sometimes suffered through a series of revolutions indeed. The suffrage revolution, sex revolution, revolution of manners, kitchen revolution, job revolution, and more recently, I suppose you could say, the educational revolution. But along the way, some parts of each have been carried forth with the others so that the revolutions became accretive. The American woman picked up new modes and new outlooks, to be sure, but they were never quite fused together, never quite reconciled, never quite rationalized. At the same time, American society decreed that her role should remain somewhat stylized and rigid through it all. She was not always permitted to overlook the fact that she was a woman and that she should be homebound first of all. And perhaps this accretion of revolutions is what led Emily Crimbo one time to comment that the American woman needs yet some years of grace. Now, with this as the backdrop, it is not surprising that most reflections on women center on the way in which she has won her way into the world of work. Indeed, as we think of the significant progress of recent years, much of it relates to the steady advances made in the utilization of woman power in the labor force. Some believe that this is one of the significant events of her time. I do. So does John Gardner, currently the secretary for whom I serve. And he put it at one of his speeches not long ago, and I quote him, "The fact is that we're witnessing a revolution in society's attitudes toward men and women of high ability and advanced training. For the first time in history, such men and women are very much in demand on a very wide scale. Throughout the ages, human societies have always been extravagantly wasteful of talent. Today, as a result of far-reaching social and technological developments," John Gardner goes on to say, "in our society, we are forced to search for talent and to use it effectively." And then he says these words, "Among the historic changes which have marked our era, this may, in the long run, prove to be one of the most profound." Mention must be made, and I'm sure it's repeating some of the remarks of my predecessors on the platform, but mention must be made, and perhaps again, of the extraordinary progress women have made in this respect in the last 5 or 6 years. During this period, they have found many new doors open to them. Many of these additional gains can be credited to the President's Commission on the Status of Women, established in 1961 by President Kennedy. As a result of the work of the Commission, a greater interest, I think, everywhere has been generalized and aroused in educating, counseling, and training women for their responsibilities as homemakers, mothers, and workers. Several important legislative acts and executive orders, I think many of them have commonly been overlooked as I go around, have marked governmental action to make the promise of equality a fact. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is of particular interest to women, since its employment provisions prohibit discrimination in employment on the basis of sex, as well as race, color, religion, or national origin. The Equal Pay Act of 1963 promised better wage protection for women by prohibiting wage discrimination on the basis of sex. Executive Order 1141, issued in 1964, is helping older women by prohibiting federal government contractors and subcontractors from arbitrary discrimination against older workers in recruitment and employment. Such pieces of legislation as the Economic Opportunity Act of 64 strikes toward equal opportunity for all, attacks the causes and consequences of poverty, and enhances our determination as a people to develop the potentialities of the most severely disadvantaged of our people, many of whom are women. And you only have to go into the urban ghetto of America to discover that in a hurry. And not very long ago, President Johnson said in connection with his search for talented women for federal government jobs, and I quote from his speech, "My whole aim in promoting women and picking out more women to serve in this administration is to underline our profound belief that we can waste no talent, we can frustrate no creative power, we can neglect no skill in our search for an open and just and challenging society." And following that, and throughout the whole government, and in the department in which I'm in health, education, and welfare, and I've been pleased to be a part of this, we now have 180 talented women working part-time in the health, education, and welfare, whose husbands serve in the government or elsewhere in Washington, and this is growing all about Washington. We have search teams out, searching all up and down that city to find people who can come in to work part of the time, hopefully full time, if it's possible. And so it is fair to assume that the growing influence of women in the working force of America is due in part to the increase in the greater consistency of this interest. In 1966, it was possible for the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor to declare, "Woman power is one of our country's greatest resources. Women's skills and abilities are being used more fully and creatively than ever before, in the home, in the community, and on the job." Well, and I just want to share a bit of documentation with you which I think bears these statements out. And I find them always rather remarkable, but I know them rather well, as perhaps you do. Since 1940, American women have been responsible for the major growth of the labor force. They accounted for more than 60% of the total increase from 40 to 64, and their representation in the labor force has risen from one-fourth to more than one-third of all workers. It is a trend that is going to continue and, in some respects, accelerate. The best estimates of population growth in the United States project the total population of 226 million in 1975 and 245 million in 1980. To produce the goods and services needed for a population of this magnitude, the Department of Labor anticipates that the economy will have 94 million men and women workers in 1975 and 101 million in 1980. It is estimated that up to that 1980 period, that women workers will show a rise of 41% as compared with only 25% for men. An equal trend is that as the demand for women as workers has increased, so have broadened opportunities for their education. One must only mention, and I only do that, the great emphasis now on the completion of high school and occupational training, on university education, and on continuing education for mature women. And to know that they are involved in the quest, these kinds of signs, we know that the quest continues for better preparation of women for jobs in the working world. And I don't know whether I should put this in because it's a bit more even than a cliche to recount, too, that the economic power of the American woman is related to actual involvement, beyond actual involvement in paid occupations. More than half of the securities in this country are owned by women, about half of the real estate, and on the whole, they are the major beneficiaries of the nation's life insurance policies. However, today, not unlike opinions expressed in 1890, many people believe that women have special qualifications and special handicaps for particular kinds of jobs, of work. The modern champions of women's rights advance much the same demands as the feminists of the late 19th century. That is, equal opportunity to maximize the special qualities of women. Thus, as Margaret Mead has pointed out, every known society maintains artificial occupational divisions and personality expectations that limit the humanity of each sex. But even Margaret Mead suspects that there are certain fields, such as physical science, mathematics, and instrumental music, in which men, as she says, will always have the razor's edge of extra gift, which makes all the difference. Well, some women themselves are quite outspoken on that behalf about freely accepting their special self-fulfillment as women. And somewhere I ran across in all of this business you collect around in your files, and as all families, you have pressures to throw it out but can't bring yourself to do it. But a speech by Mary Roebling, chairman of the board of the Trenton Trust Company, said in a speech some time ago to the Pennsylvania Federation of Women's Clubs, and I pulled this out as I looked through it. She says, "As a banker, I'm keenly aware of the power and use of money. But as a woman and as a grandmother, I'm even more profoundly impressed," as she put it, "with the roles that God has given alone to women, to be wives and to be mothers, and of their responsibility to sustain and support moral values." Well, you can get into a rather deep field of thought if you go very far in that way, and I don't intend to, except to say that the old traditional view sustains today even that employment may be antagonistic to woman's immutable emotional needs. According to this viewpoint, old and new, women who work are sure to compromise their own femininity, and as some believe, their husband's masculinity, and to arouse deep conflicts and anxieties in the process. One may suspect that there is little, as I do, psychiatric evidence for this strain. Yet there seems to be little question that many women in American society do not work because they or their husbands are convinced that the home, in the long run, is woman's natural environment. And interestingly enough, when she does work, normally the burdens of home are no less reduced. One way or the other, mixing that all up, such feelings produce a great deal of tension between individual and family goals. Now, if we can find the missing ingredient and search for it, namely, the development of new institutions in American society which enable women to perform easily and casually in two or more basic roles, we shall likely wonder when that day comes, on the one hand, why there was so much argument of male versus female. And on the other, women may discover without even knowing when the time comes how to see themselves as they are and thereby gain a new authenticity. But be that as it may, everything points to the more active involvement of women in full-fledged positions and occupations. The growth in the size and number of human tasks in a technical society bring more women in jobs together. The trend will likely engender motives for limiting the number of children in most families, increase the efficiency still further in households, facilitate the purchase of goods and services, and on the whole, lighten the burden of domesticity. Let us hope that it happens this way. Let us hope that it happens this way. For it seems certain that such changes will mean that more and more mothers will be left with an empty nest. We did not collaborate, Dr. Gass and I, at an earlier age and in a better state of health than mothers in the past. And again, if the middle years of women are not to become a second discouraging adolescence, all of us must help this new authenticity to occur. My third comment, or set of comments, refers to the new era of human development, which strains now to the surface of American life. I cannot overstate enough what is happening. Some kind of new epic shaping around us, into the future. Accent on human beings, accent on their fulfillment, growth, and development. And let me just try to be a little rhetorical and try to prove that to you. On every side, it takes little observation to see that people are sort of edging forward to want to prevent things rather than to only cure them. Go into any community and talk to the people. There's a sign there. Most of us seem willing to give understanding an equal chance with exploitation. Indeed, exploitation has become a bad word, assistance a good one. It has become frighteningly clear that what one man enjoys cannot be separated any longer from what another man suffers, thanks to mass media and other communications. Old themes are taking on more urgent meanings, reducing, if not removing, deprivation. Every newspaper filled with this. Equalizing opportunity. In 3 years, we have somehow suddenly discovered as a people that we have had unequal opportunities after preaching it for 100 years. Human rehabilitation. The amount of federal funds now going into the rehabilitation of human beings is tenfold what it was 3 years ago. And your representatives and congressmen voted it in. New vocabularies are springing up. Housing and urban development, model cities, Medicare, rent supplements, compensatory education, we weren't using these kinds of terms 5 years ago. To support them, more laws have been passed than some people could have believed possible. More in 5 years than in a century. Private and public life find new ways to work together. And this cacophony of new words, new hopes, new laws, new resources, and new relationships move all of the institutions of social life toward a renewed concern with the families, communities around them. And it is a fundamental concern to the future of women in this or any other society. As they and as men and all of us relate to this new epoch, the tasks of doing it are enormous. And the tasks are great, ladies and gentlemen, because we are still trying to make strong-mindedness work. We still believe that strong-mindedness will pay off more than tender-heartedness in the long run. And that is why the gulf between aspiration and achievement sometimes grows wider. The tasks of doing it are enormous, I think, fundamentally for this reason. Old ideas sidetrack the new ones. The tools are blunt. Old tools, new issues. Burdens are greater than the resources to carry them. Short-term crises swallow up the most steadfast projects. New efforts can be criticized out of existence before they actually begin. Fixing blame can eat up the time of getting the job done. And I couldn't be more blunt with you, and all of us are partially guilty, especially middle-class, white-collared, well-educated graduates like us of such reputable places like Illinois. We are, as much as anything else, guilty of the following, and that is one of the blocks and one of the troubles is that while more and more people sense the system's brutalities, for too many of us, the system has been too good to change it. Another related point of even more direct relevance to, I think, the future of woman power. We are well into a period of concern about the lack of people necessary for human-serving programs. And I must say to you, if I've learned anything in a year and a half in Washington, that this country is in a crisis of depletion. There are depletions on every side. Just let me illustrate a moment. We put more and more money into more and more education, but the depletions grow. In order to get by in the United States in medical practice, last year, 18% of the physicians practiced, licensed for practice, we're foreign-born and foreign-trained. We could not keep medical practice going in this country without the subsistences of the countries of the world. Indeed, even with that, 18% of them coming in from other countries, there is a persistent decline in the number of physicians in private practice relative to population growth. You know how adverse the distribution is. A fourth of all nursing positions in this country are unfilled at this moment. We have 200,000 teaching positions unfilled, or filled by part-time, less than full-fledged certificates. It is surprising to some that our country ranks 12th among the nations of the earth in infant mortality rate. And there are some counties and some states in this country where we have infant mortality rates that will compare with the poorest developing countries of the world. In every waking moment, we are reminded of the congestion, other environmental problems which reduce the quality of life, and the countless children who go unloved and uncared for. There are some advocates, as you know, who argue that we have overpriced the economic value of work and that self-serving motives have continued far beyond their time. You've heard those advocates speak. And regardless of the plans which these advocates suggest, and I'm not saying one way or the other about them, it is certain that until the last talent of America is identified and put to work, the supply will be inadequate. And now I've only made about a couple of points in my paper, and I want to make another one parenthetically. We've had all kinds of symposia for the last roughly 25 years as heightened interest in the status of women has come to the fore. And it's been a kind of polite affair where women largely come together and sort of suffer through and sort of together anguish over what their identity is going to be. A few men have joined the ranks, but most have sort of stood by and idled away their own time. Ladies and gentlemen, if my proposition that we are now moving in, even for the survival of the race, an epic of human development, all of this is a kind of a polite exercise for the symposium, is over. All of these sort of silly rules of nepotism that even universities have sustained is over. All of these husbands who really in their hearts like families for a kind of polite public screen to get on with their own professions is over. All of this business that a woman really has to take 15 years out to go into a psychic cave for the business of bearing and rearing children, and then we say, when that's nicely done, they can come back to an institute and we will redo them. That foolishness is over. We have a daughter who is 23. Again, forgive the personal reference. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate. Now in the process of sorting out her boys. And as she has talked to her parents a little bit about criteria. Not quite that baldly, but that's the way we like to work it around. And one of the criteria for her father is that if the young man has certain kinds of stuffy feelings about you taking 15 years out of your life to bear and to rear his children while he's eating steaks in Chicago at the restaurants, at professional conferences, put a great big black mark down for him. You go on to school, you find yourself a husband if you want to, I tell her. But you sort of get a guy who will let you, after about 10 or 12 months when the youngsters come along, find ways to renew your love for them and for him. And let him know something of the love of admiration because he has a vital and continually vital wife. And if he doesn't like that, wait a while longer and look at some others. These sort of polite exercises, ladies and gentlemen, are over. We are suffering in this country because the achievements which we're capable of setting for ourselves, we can't reach. We have depletions of talent. We have depletions of leadership. And all of these polite holds off, I think, are over. And that is the great grace and the future, I think, of women as we look ahead. Well, the point of these remarks at this moment, as I come down to the close, is that human serving tasks call for a new measure, as we have never seen before, of tender-heartedness over strong-mindedness. Now I raise a warning flag to my colleagues who spoke earlier and to many of you in the room. Because, and the flag is that I would hope that as women pursue what I think is the current revolution of authentic diversity, their drive will not move single-mindedly toward those jobs which are valued alone for their economic value. My hunch is that if they are so single-minded, by the time they reach that goal, and they will, They will forego the important tasks of a technological society that is awaiting them. As one reads newspapers from around the world, our own, he can almost see mankind trapped inside a barrel, rolling rapidly down the hill, unsure of what the catastrophe will be at the end of the ride. Somehow, we've got to find ways to have some of the people get out of the barrel, run on down the hill to see if they can do something about shaping the tracks ahead. If modern technical society is to survive, guidelines are required that include stronger doses of affection as well as logic than we've ever had before. And it is important that women consider that what they have been through to win a place in the world at large has, by the rigors of it, cultivated their influence in examining the values of the social order. Certainly, they can help bring specialized fields of thought into new and more general statements of the humaneness of man. For instance, with the complex aggregation in metropolitan areas, more and more participation must take place in newly devised neighborhoods. As a sociologist, I say that one of the reasons why poverty programs are bogging down is that somehow there is not a system of participation of human beings where they live. We're going to have to build this all over again for our society. As the mass media diffuse patterns of aspiration and achievement on a worldwide basis, and as the gulf between aspiration and achievement continues to widen, as your food seminar, I'm sure, said, affection and tenderness must come to characterize nation states and world and the world community alike. And voluntary associations, many of them led by women, and too many of them self-serving, must find new ways to help lead the way. I'm saying, in short, that if women settle for the that's my danger flag, that if women settle for the occupational imitation of men, they may really miss and be blocked from these newly essential human-serving tasks. In the new society, where freeing every human being, man and woman, married and single, with or without children, freeing every human being to the best that is in him, that, ladies and gentlemen, is the heart of the matter. And to make it go, and to pull it off, we will have to call upon the woman power of nations around the world, hope that they jump ahead of current events, and build on that single bond of all humanity, its unmitigated concern for children. People everywhere are groping to each other, into larger and larger groups, wanting to do it, yet not knowing how quite to bring it off. And at the moment, all of us are demanded to be tough and unrelenting on the one hand, and kind and nurturing on the other. It has been our age that on the one hand produces technological war and kill millions of people, and on the other hand produces technological medicine and save millions of people. What a paradox. What an anachronism. We're pulled in these ways. I've been pulled somewhat in my time. At Christmas in 1964 and 1965,